Chapter 18. Until I die. My whole life long I learned to love. This hour my utmost art I prove, and speak my passion, heaven or hell. She will not give me heaven, 'tis well. Robert Browning, One Way of Love.
Miss! Miss!
Tess awoke slowly, Sophie shaking her shoulder. Sunlight was streaming through the windows high above. Sophie was smiling, her eyes alight.
Mrs. Branwell sent me to bring you back to your room. You can't stay here forever.
Ugh, I wouldn't want to. Tessa sat up, then closed her eyes as dizziness washed through her.
You might have to help me up, Sophie,
she said in an apologetic voice.
I'm not as steady as I could be.
Of course, miss.
Sophie reached down and briskly helped Tessa out of the bed. Despite her slenderness, she was quite strong. She'd have to be, wouldn't she, Tessa thought, from years of carrying heavy laundry up and down stairs and coal from the coal scuttle to the grates. Tessa winced a bit as her feet struck the cold floor and couldn't help glancing over to see if Will was in his infirmary bed. He wasn't. Is Will all right? She asked as Sophie helped her slide her feet into slippers. I woke for a bit yesterday and saw them taking the metal out of his back. It looked dreadful. Sophie snorted.
Looked worse than it was then. Mr. Arendelle barely let the Murazzi in before he left. Off into the night to do the devil knows what.
Was he? I could have sworn I spoke to him last night.
They were in the corridor now, Sophie guiding Tessa with a gentle hand on her back. Images were starting to take shape in Tessa's head. Images of Will in the moonlight, of herself telling him that nothing mattered, it was only a dream. And it had been, hadn't it?
You must have dreamed it, miss.
They had reached Tessa's room, and Sophie was distracted, trying to get the doorknob turned without letting go of Tessa. It's all right, Sophie. I can stand on my own. Sophie protested, but Tessa insisted firmly enough that Sophie soon had the door open and was stoking the fire in the grate while Tessa sank into an armchair. There was a pot of tea and a plate of sandwiches on the table beside the bed, and she helped herself to it gratefully. She no longer felt dizzy, but she did feel tired, with a weariness that was more spiritual than physical. She remembered the bitter taste of the tisane she'd drunk, and the way it had felt to be held by Will. But that had been a dream. She wondered how much else of what she'd seen last night had been a dream. Jem whispering at the foot of her bed, Jessamine sobbing into her blankets in the silent city.
I was sorry to hear about your brother, miss.
Sophie was on her knees by the fire, the rekindling flames playing over her lovely face. Her head was bent, and Tessa could not see her scar.
You don't have to say that, Sophie. I know it was his fault, really, about Agatha and Thomas.
But he was your brother.
Sophie's voice was firm.
Blood mourns blood.
She bent farther over the coals, and there was something about the kindness in her voice and the way her hair curled, dark and vulnerable against the nape of her neck, that made Tessa say, Sophie, I saw you with Gideon the other day. Sophie stiffened immediately, all over without turning to look at Tessa.
What do you mean, miss?
I came back to get my necklace, Tessa said. My clockwork angel, for luck. And I saw you with Gideon in the corridor. She swallowed. He was pressing your hand like a suitor. There was a long, long silence while Sophie stared into the flickering fire. At last she said,
Are you going to tell Mrs. Branwell?
Tessa recoiled.
What? Sophie, no, I just wanted to warn you.
Sophie's voice was flat.
Warn me against what?
The Lightwoods.
Tessa swallowed.
They are not nice people. When I was at their house, with Will, I saw dreadful things, awful.
That's Mr. Lightwood, not his sons.
The sharpness in Sophie's voice made Tessa flinch.
They're not like him.
How different could they be?
Sophie stood up, the poker clattering into the fire.
You think I'm such a fool that I'd let some half-hour gentleman make a mockery of me after all I've been through? after all Mrs. Branwell's taught me. Gideon's a good man. It's a question of upbringing, Sophie. Can you picture him going to Benedict Lightwood and saying he wants to marry a mundane and a parlor maid to boot? Can you see him doing that? Sophie's face twisted. You don't know anything, she said. You don't know what he'd do for us. You mean the training? Tessa was incredulous. Sophie, really? But Sophie, shaking her head, had gathered up her skirts and stalked from the room, letting the door slam shut behind her. Charlotte, her elbows on the desk in the drawing room, sighed and balled up her 14th piece of paper and tossed it into the fireplace. The fire sparked up for a moment, consuming the paper as it turned black and fell to ashes. She picked up her pen, dipped it into the inkwell, and began again.
I, Charlotte Mary Branwell, daughter of Nephilim, do hereby and on this date tender my resignation as the director of the London Institute, on behalf of myself and of my husband, Henry Jocelyn Branwell.
Charlotte?
Her hand jerked, sending a blot of ink sprawling across the page, ruining her careful lettering. She looked up and saw Henry, hovering by the desk, a worried look on his thin, freckled face. She set her pen down. She was conscious, as she always was with Henry, and rarely at any other times, of her physical appearance, that her hair was escaping from its chignon, that her dress was not new and had an ink blot on the sleeve, and that her eyes were tired and puffy from weeping.
What is it, Henry?
Henry hesitated.
It's just that I've been... Darling, what are you writing?
He came around the desk, glancing over her shoulder.
Charlotte!
He snatched the paper off the desk. Though ink had smeared through the letters, enough of what she had written was left for him to get the gist.
Resigning from the Institute? How can you?
Better to resign than to have Consul Wayland come in over my head and force me out, Charlotte said quietly.
Don't you mean us?
Henry looked hurt.
Should I have at least a say in this decision? You've never taken an interest in the running of the Institute before. Why would you now?
Henry looked as if she had slapped him, and it was all Charlotte could do not to get up and put her arms around him and kiss his freckled cheek. She remembered, when she had fallen in love with him, how she had thought he reminded her of an adorable puppy, with his hands just a bit too large for the rest of him, his wide hazel eyes, his eager demeanor. That the mind behind those eyes was as sharp and intelligent as her own was something she had always believed, even when others had laughed at Henry's eccentricities. She had always thought it would be enough just to be near him always and love him whether he loved her or not. But that had been before.
Charlotte, he said now, I know why you're angry with me.
Her chin jerked up in surprise. Could he truly be that perceptive? Despite her conversation with Brother Enoch, she had thought no one had noticed. She had barely been able to think about it herself, much less how Henry would react when he knew.
You do? I wouldn't go with you to meet with Wolsey Scott.
Relief and disappointment warred in Charlotte's breast.
Henry, she sighed. That is hardly... I didn't realize, he said. Sometimes I get so caught up in my ideas. You've always known that about me, Lottie.
Charlotte flushed. He so rarely called her that.
I would change it if I could. Of all the people in the world, I did think you understood. You know it isn't just tinkering for me. You know I want to create something that will make the world better, that will make things better for the Nephilim. Just as you do in directing the Institute, and though I know I will always come second for you. Second for me?
Charlotte's voice shot up to an incredulous squeak.
You come second for me? It's all right, Lottie,
Henry said with incredible gentleness.
I knew when you agreed to marry me that it was because you needed to be married to run the Institute, that no one would accept a woman alone in the position of director. Henry?
Charlotte rose to her feet, trembling.
How can you say such terrible things to me?
Henry looked baffled.
I thought that was just the way it was. Do you think I don't know why you married me?
Charlotte cried.
Do you think I don't know about the money your father owed my father? Or that my father promised to forgive the debt if you'd marry me? He always wanted a boy, someone to run the institute after him. If he couldn't have that, well, why not pay to marry his unmarriageable daughter? Too plain, too headstrong, off to some poor boy who is just doing his duty by his family. Charlotte!
Henry had turned brick red. She had never seen him so angry.
What on earth are you talking about?
Charlotte braced herself against the desk.
You know very well, she said. It is why you married me, isn't it? You've never said a word about this to me before today. Why would I? It's nothing you didn't know. It is, actually.
Henry's eyes were blazing.
I knew nothing of my father's owing yours anything. I went to your father in good faith and asked him if he would do me the honour of allowing me to ask for your hand in marriage. There was never any discussion of money.
Charlotte caught her breath. In the years they had been married, she had never said a word about the circumstances of her betrothal to Henry. There had never seemed a reason, and she had never before wanted to hear any stammered denials of what she knew was true. Hadn't her father said it to her when he had told her of Henry's proposal?
He is a good enough man, better than his father, and you need some sort of a husband, Charlotte, if you are going to direct the Institute. I've forgiven his father's debt, so that matter is closed between our families.
Of course, he had never said, not in so many words, that was why Henry had asked to marry her. She had assumed.
You are not plain,
Henry said, his face still blazing.
You are beautiful. And I didn't ask your father if I could marry you out of duty. I did it because I loved you. I've always loved you. I'm your husband. I didn't think you wanted to be, she whispered.
Henry was shaking his head.
I know people call me eccentric, peculiar, even mad. All of those things I've never minded. But for you to think I'd be so weak-willed, do you even love me at all? Of course I love you, Charlotte cried. That was never in question. Wasn't it? Do you think I don't hear what people say? They speak about me as if I weren't there, as if I were some sort of half-wit. I've heard Benedict Lightwood say enough times that you married me only so that you could pretend a man was running the Institute.
Now it was Charlotte's turn to be angry.
And you criticize me for thinking you weak-willed. Henry, I'd never marry you for that reason. Never in 1,000 years. I'd give up the Institute in a moment before I'd give up.
Henry was staring at her, his hazel eyes wide, his ginger hair bristling, as if he had run his hands madly through it so many times that he was in danger of pulling it out in chunks.
Before you'd give up what? Before I'd give you up,
she said.
Don't you know that?
And then she said nothing else, for Henry put his arms around her and kissed her. Kissed her in such a way that she no longer felt plain, or conscious of her hair, or the ink spot on her dress, or anything but Henry, whom she had always loved. Tears welled up and spilled down her cheeks, and when he drew away, he touched her wet face wonderingly.
Really?
He said.
You love me too, Lottie. Of course I do. I didn't marry you so I'd have someone to run the Institute with, Henry. I married you because I knew I wouldn't mind how difficult directing this place was, or how badly the Clave treated me. If I knew yours would be the last face I saw every night before I went to sleep.
She hit him lightly on the shoulder.
We've been married for years, Henry. What did you think I felt about you?
He shrugged his thin shoulders and kissed the top of her head.
I thought you were fond of me, he said gruffly. I thought you might come to love me in time. That's what I thought about you, she said wonderingly. Could we really both have been so stupid?
Well, I'm not surprised about me, said Henry. But honestly, Charlotte, you ought to have known better.
She choked back a laugh.
Henry!
She squeezed his arms.
There's something else I have to tell you. Something very important.
The door to the drawing room banged open. It was Will. Henry and Charlotte drew apart and stared at him. He looked exhausted, pale, with dark rings about his eyes. But there was a clarity in his face Charlotte had never seen before, a sort of brilliance in his expression. She braced herself for a sarcastic remark or cold observation, but instead he just smiled happily at them. Henry, Charlotte, he said. You haven't seen Tessa, have you?
She's likely in her room, said Charlotte, bewildered. Will, is something the matter? Oughtn't you be resting after the injuries you sustained?
Will waved this away. Your excellent Irazis did their work. I don't require rest. I only wish to see Tessa and to ask you. He broke off, staring at the letter on Charlotte's desk. With a few strides of his long legs, he had reached the desk and snatched it up, and read it, with the same look of dismay Henry had worn.
Charlotte? No, you can't give up the Institute. The Cleave will find you another place to live, Charlotte said. Or you may stay here until you turn 18, though the Lightwoods. I wouldn't want to live here without you and Henry. What do you think I'd stay for, the ambiance?
Will shook the piece of paper till it crackled.
I even bloody Miss Jessamine. Well, a bit. And the Lightwoods will sack our servants and replace them with their own. Charlotte, you can't let it happen. This is our home. It's Jem's home, Sophie's home.
Charlotte stared.
Will, are you sure you haven't a fever? Charlotte!
Will slammed the paper back down onto the desk.
I forbid you to resign your directorship. Do you understand?
Over all these years, you've done everything for me, as if I were your own blood, and I've never told you I was grateful.
That goes for you as well, Henry. But I am grateful, and because of it, I shall not let you make this mistake.
Will, said Charlotte,
it is over. We have only 3 days to find Mortmain, and we cannot possibly do so. There simply is not time.
Hang Mortmain, said Will. And I mean that literally, of course, but also figuratively.
The 2-week limit on finding Mortmain was in essence set by Benedict Lightwood as a ridiculous test. A test that, as it turns out, was a cheat. He is working for Mortmain. This test was his attempt to leverage the Institute out from under you. If we but expose Benedict for what he is, Mortmain's puppet, the Institute is yours again, and the search for Mortmain can continue. We have Jessamine's word that to expose Benedict is to play into Mortmain's hands. We cannot do nothing, Will said firmly. It is worth at least a conversation, don't you think?
Charlotte couldn't think of a word to say. This Will was not a Will she knew. He was firm, straightforward, intensity shining in his eyes. If Henry's silence was anything to go by, he was just as surprised. Will nodded as if taking this for agreement.
Excellent, he said. I'll tell Sophie to round up the others.
And he darted from the room. Charlotte stared up at her husband, all thoughts of the news she had wished to tell him driven from her mind.
Was that Will?
She said finally. Henry arched one ginger eyebrow.
Perhaps he's been kidnapped and replaced by an automaton, he suggested. It seems possible.
For once, Charlotte could only find herself in agreement. Glumly, Tessa finished the sandwiches and the rest of the tea, cursing her inability to keep her nose out of other people's business. Once she was done, she put on her blue dress, finding the task difficult without Sophie's assistance.
Look at yourself, she thought. Spoiled, after just a few weeks of having a lady's maid.
Can't dress yourself. Can't stop nosing about where you're not wanted. Soon you'll be needing someone to spoon gruel into your mouth or you'll starve. She made a horrible face at herself in the mirror and sat down at her vanity table, picking up the silver-backed hairbrush and pulling the bristles through her long brown hair. A knock came at the door. Sophie, Tessa thought hopefully, back for an apology. Well, she would get one. Tessa dropped the hairbrush and rushed to throw the door open. Just as once before she had expected Jem and been disappointed to find Sophie on her threshold, now, in expecting Sophie, she was surprised to find Jem at her door. He wore a gray wool jacket and trousers, against which his silvery hair looked nearly white. Jem, she said, startled. Is everything all right? His gray eyes searched her face, her long, loose hair. You look as if you were waiting for someone else. Sophie, Tessa sighed, and tucked a stray curl behind her ear. I fear I have offended her. My habit of speaking before I think has caught me out again. Oh, said Jem, with an uncharacteristic lack of interest. Usually he would have asked Tessa what she had said to Sophie, and either reassured her or helped her plot a course of action to win Sophie's forgiveness. His customary vivid interest in everything seemed oddly missing, Tessa thought with alarm. He was quite pale, as well, and seemed to be glancing behind her as if checking to see whether she was quite alone. I would like to speak to you in private, Tessa. Are you feeling well enough? That depends on what you have to tell me, she said with a laugh. But when her laugh brought no answering smile, apprehension rose inside her. Jem, you promise everything's all right. Will? This is not about Will, he said. Will is out wandering and no doubt perfectly all right. This is about, well, I suppose you might say it's about me. He glanced up and down the corridor. Might I come in? Tessa briefly thought about what Aunt Harriet would say about a girl who allowed a boy she was not related to into her bedroom when there was no one else there. But then, Aunt Harriet herself had been in love once, Tessa thought. Enough in love to let her fiancé do, well, whatever it was exactly that left one with child. Aunt Harriet, had she been alive, would have been in no position to talk. And besides, etiquette was different for shadow hunters. She opened the door wide. Yes, come in. Jem came into the room and shut the door firmly behind him. He walked over to the grate and leaned an arm against the mantel. Then, seeming to decide that this position was unsatisfactory, he came over to where Tessa was, in the middle of the room, and stood in front of her. Tessa, he said. Jem, she replied, mimicking his serious tone, but again he did not smile. Jem, she said again, more quietly. If this is about your health, your illness, please tell me. I will do whatever I can to help you. It is not, he said, about my illness. He took a deep breath. You know we have not found Mortmain, he said. In a few days, the Institute may be given to Benedict Lightwood. He would doubtless allow Will and me to remain here, but not you. And I have no desire to live in a house that he runs. And Will and Gabriel would kill each other inside a minute. It would be the end of our little group. Charlotte and Henry would find a house, I have no doubt, and Will and I perhaps would go to Idris until we were 18, and Jessie, I suppose it depends what sentence the Clave passes on her, but we could not bring you to Idris with us. You are not a shadow hunter. Tessa's heart had begun to beat very fast. She sat down, rather suddenly, on the edge of her bed. She felt faintly sick. She remembered Gabriel's sneering jibe about the Lightwoods finding employment for her. Having been to the ball at their house, she could imagine little worse. I see, she said. But where should I go? No, do not answer that. You hold no responsibility towards me. Thank you for telling me, at least. Tessa! You have already been as kind as propriety has allowed, she said. Given that allowing me to live here has done none of you any good in the eyes of the Clave, I shall find a place. Your place is with me, Jem said. It always will be. What do you mean? He flushed, the color dark against his pale skin. I mean, he said, Tessa Gray, will you do me the honor of becoming my wife? Tessa sat bolt upright. Jem! They stared at each other for a moment. At last he said, trying for lightness, though his voice cracked,
"That was not a no, I suppose, though neither was it a yes."
"You can't mean it."
"I do mean it."
"You can't. I'm not a shadow hunter. They'll expel you from the clave."
He took a step closer to her, his eyes eager.
"You may not be precisely a shadow hunter, but you are not a mundane either, nor probably a downworlder. Your situation is unique, so I do not know what the clave will do. But they cannot forbid something that is not forbidden by the law. They will have to take our individual case into consideration, and that could take months. In the meantime, they cannot prevent our engagement."
"You are serious."
Her mouth was dry.
"Jem, such a kindness on your part is indeed incredible. It does you credit. But I cannot let you sacrifice yourself in that way for me."
"Sacrifice? Tessa, I love you. I want to marry you.
Jem, it is just that you are kind, so selfless. How can I trust that you are not doing this simply for my sake?"
He reached into the pocket of his waistcoat and drew out something smooth and circular. It was a pendant of whitish-green jade, with Chinese characters carved into it that she could not read. He held it out to her with a hand that trembled ever so slightly.
"I could give you my family ring," he said.
"But that is meant to be given back when the engagement is over, exchanged for runes. I want to give you something that will be yours forever." She shook her head.
"I cannot possibly,"
he interrupted her. "This was given to my mother by my father when they married. The writing is from the I Ching, the Book of Changes. It says, when two people are at one in their inmost hearts, they shatter even the strength of iron or bronze."
"And you think we are?"
Tessa asked, shock making her voice small.
"At one, that is."
Jem knelt down at her feet so that he was gazing up into her face. She saw him as he had been on Blackfriars Bridge, a lovely silver shadow against the darkness.
"I cannot explain, love," he said. "I could not tell you if I loved you the first moment I saw you, or if it was the second or third or fourth. But I remember the first moment I looked at you, walking toward me, and realized that somehow the rest of the world seemed to vanish when I was with you. That you were the center of everything I did and felt and thought."
Overwhelmed, Tessa shook her head, slowly.
"Jem, I never imagined."
"There is a force and strength in love," he said. "That is what the inscription means. It is in the Shadowhunter wedding ceremony, too. For love is as strong as death. Have you not seen how much better I have been these past weeks, Tessa? I have been ill less, coughing less. I feel stronger. I need less of the drug because of you. Because my love for you sustains me."
Tessa stared. Was such a thing even possible, outside of fairy tales? His thin face glowed with light. It was clear he believed it, absolutely. And he had been better.
"You speak of sacrifice, but it is not my sacrifice I offer. It is yours I ask of you," he went on. "I can offer you my life, but it is a short life. I can offer you my heart, though I have no idea how many more beats it shall sustain. But I love you enough to hope that you will not care that I am being selfish in trying to make the rest of my life, whatever its length, happy by spending it with you. I want to be married to you, Tessa. I want it more than I have ever wanted anything else in my life."
He looked up at her through the veil of silvery hair that fell over his eyes.
"That is,"
he said shyly,
"if you love me too."
Tessa looked down at Jem, kneeling before her with the pendant in his hands, and understood at last what people meant when they said someone's heart was in their eyes. For Jem's eyes, his luminous, expressive eyes that she had always found beautiful, were full of love and hope. And why should he not hope? She had given him every reason to believe she loved him. Her friendship, her trust, her confidence, her gratitude, even her passion. And if there was some small, locked-away part of herself that had not quite given up Will, surely she owed it to herself, as much as to Jem, to do whatever she could to destroy it. Very slowly, she reached down and took the pendant from Jem. It slipped around her neck on a gold chain, as cool as water, and rested in the hollow of her throat, above the spot where the clockwork angel lay. As she lowered her hands from its clasp, she saw the hope in his eyes light to an almost unbearable blaze of disbelieving happiness. She felt as if someone had reached inside her chest and unlocked a box that held her heart, spilling tenderness like new blood through her veins. Never had she felt such an overwhelming urge to fiercely protect another person, to wrap her arms around someone else and curl up tightly with them, alone and away from the rest of the world. "Then yes," she said. "Yes, I will marry you, James Carstairs. Yes." "Thank God," he said, exhaling. "Thank God." And he buried his face in her lap, wrapping his arms around her waist. She bent over him, stroking his shoulders, his back, the silk of his hair. His heart pounded against her knees. Some small inner part of her was reeling with amazement. She had never imagined she had the power to make someone else so happy. And not a magical power, either. A purely human one. A knock came at the door. They sprang apart. Tessa hastily rose to her feet and made her way to the door, pausing to smooth down her hair and, she hoped, calm her expression, before opening it. This time it really was Sophie, though her mutinous expression showed she had not come of her own accord. "Charlotte is summoning you to the drawing room, miss," she said. "Master Will has returned, and she wishes to have a meeting." She glanced past Tessa, and her expression soured further. "You too, Master Jim." "Sophie," Tessa began, but Sophie had already turned and was hurrying away, her white cap bobbing. Tessa tightened her grip on the doorknob, looking after her. Sophie had said that she did not mind Jem's feelings for Tessa, and Tessa knew now that Gideon was the reason why. Still, she felt Jem come up behind her and slip his hands into hers. His fingers were slender. She closed her own around them and let out her held breath. Was this what it meant to love someone? That any burden was a burden shared? That they could give you comfort with a word or a touch? She leaned her head back against his shoulder, and he kissed her temple. "We'll tell Charlotte first, when there's a chance," he said, "and then the others, once the fate of the Institute is decided." "You sound as if you don't mind what happens to it," said Tessa. "Won't you miss it here? This place has been your home." His fingers stroked her wrist lightly, making her shiver. "You are home for me now,"